Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
You know, you can't tell how tired I am because I'm a professional.
Uh-huh.
So why I'm tired is this past weekend, we had a scout camping weekend. Yes, this is the first weekend of March in Massachusetts. That means it was cold.
It's technically winter camping. I know some of y'all are having spring already and flowers and stuff. We do not have that. It is.
We're still at igloos, y'all.
How cold was it, Dom?
The low for the night was 19 degrees, at least as far as I could tell. It might have got colder, but when I looked, it was 19.
That is
13 degrees below freezing.
Yeah.
And that's Fahrenheit. So it was cold and we were in tents. So it was a scout camping trip for both Ben's scout troop and Bella and Sophie's scout troop combined. And so we all went to Camp Squanto, which is a scout camp here in Massachusetts, in our council area. It's in Plymouth, Massachusetts, the home of the Plymouth Rock, the most, how would you put it? The least impressive historical monument
The most underwhelming?
Yes.
Historical monument ever.
That's a whole nother story. But it's in Plymouth, Massachusetts, which is a scrub pine barren, the pine barrens, they call it.
Right.
So it's a scrub pine. How do you describe scrub pine? It's not tall, majestic pine trees. They're all kind of twisty and semi-short, partly because they grow in very sandy soil.
Because it's near the ocean.
Near the ocean. Anyway, it's not really all that relevant, I suppose, but it came to mind.
Again, we're tired.
Yes, but also partly because the pine barrens are notorious for being colder than every place around it. Like the pine barrens describes a large area of southern Massachusetts and the Cape Cod. So, and it's notorious for being colder than other areas, just the way the geography is. So we chose wisely. And so we got down there Saturday morning. Some of the scouts camped overnight Friday night, but we didn't. We came down Saturday morning. And I basically sat by the fire
all day
and except to get up to eat and then sit back down again. I had to set up the tents and all that thing. We had two tents. We had our big tents and then the little tent. Ben and I were in the big tent. I brought my cot. I do not sleep on the ground anymore. It's not being soft. I'm over 50 years old. It hurts to sleep on the ground. I'm sorry. Just it hurts. So I have a cot that I sleep in, and it was fun. The kids had a blast. They were running all over the place all day. They played a game called Gaga Ball. I'm not entirely sure of the rules, but it involves something like a bunch of kids in a circle, a ball that they bat on the ground with their hands. They can't touch it with their feet, and the ball can up go into the air, and they have to hit other kids with the ball to get them out. So it's sort of like dodgeball. Very low to the ground or something. They also did Indian stick wrestling, which is probably politically incorrect to call it that, but it's where the two kids hold on to a stick and try to force the other out of the circle. It's sort of a non-sumo thing. Bella actually beat one of the boys because while he was probably stronger, she's taller, thus leverage.
Yeah, significantly taller.
Yes, and she used his strength against him by letting him push her to the edge and then flipping him sideways over the line.
I think she also, yeah, she was taller, but she also fought smart.
Yes. They all had a good time. Ben and Sophie and Bella, in varying degrees, they all did very well. It was cold. All right, let's talk. Okay, let's talk about the cold. It was cold. I slept fully clothed. including my winter coat, in my mummy bag that I didn't quite fit in. I'm already planning to buy a bigger 0-degree bag that I can actually zip in. And I was like all night, every 20 minutes, a half hour, I would wake up and try to shift in such a way as to cover myself more with the sleeping bag. It was so cold. The kids I gather were fine. Like Bella had trouble falling asleep, but once she was asleep, she stayed asleep. Sophie was fine. Ben, I had to actually when I came into the tent, he was already asleep. I had to rejigger it so that the stuff was over him, but he was fine. He said he woke up a lot. And
he did. He was really tired when y'all came home.
Yeah, they were all like dragging it at prayer time at right before bed.
Ben didn't make it to prayer time.
Yeah, Ben was out before that. So I woke up it was starting to get light out. I'm like, oh, maybe it's time to get up and they'll have started the fire. And I look at my watch and it's, what did it say? 3:49. I'm like, oh, please let this night be over. And so finally at 5, Ben got up and he was moving around. So I got up with him and I took him to there was a bathroom, heated bathroom. It was a bit of a walk. It was a long ways away, but it was a heated bathroom. I almost didn't want to come back from the bathroom. It was so blessedly warm. You know, I could feel my fingers. Oh my gosh. Fingers and toes. But there was plenty of coffee and, you know, hot cocoa and all that sort of stuff. And the scout leaders are always really good. For one thing, they feed the kids really well. The kids always have plenty of food to eat, which means the adults do too. And I'll talk a little bit about the food when we talk about our in our cooking segment. But it was really good as usual. And unluckily, we picked the weekend before it's about to turn warm. Next weekend, it's going to be like a high of 60. So we could have been in that, but it's okay. We can say we did it. We camped in 19 degree.
You did.
Weather. So, and then now the things are loosening up a bit with all the restrictions. We should be camping like once a month from here on out, which is interesting. So we'll see how that goes. So while I was there with the three older ones, you were here.
I was home with Anthony and Lucy.
How'd that go? What'd you guys do?
It was pretty good. Yesterday morning, we made chocolate muffins and they both helped. There was a little bit of squabbling over who got to, you know, hold the mixer and stuff, but they were good. And we also watched Pope Francis's Mass from Baghdad, which was really cool. Wow. He's in Iraq and we're watching Mass and it's really awesome. They both, you know, kind of wandered in and out, but mostly like Anthony was glued to the screen watching. He thought it was really great. He was especially loving the music.
Yeah.
We took a walk and then we watched The Princess Bride.
Cool.
Which,
because the older kids have seen it, but
Anthony and Lucy had both seen it before, but neither one of them remembered it. It's been a few years.
And every time we quote it, they get mad. Because they don't remember it.
It's been a few years. So we watched that. I honestly fell asleep a couple times during it, but they were fine.
During the fire swamp scene, how was that?
I kind of woke up like at the near the beginning of the fire swamp scene.
Yeah.
And I kind of glanced over and they were fine. They both had their blankets over their heads and like pulled up
over
like,
their noses.
Over their noses. And so they were just, I saw like two little lumps of blanket with eyes peeking out. But they were fine. They were fine. They thought it was funny and they enjoyed it thoroughly. And then they played for a little while. We had some dinner. We just had
dinner go. The reason I ask is I'm sitting by the campfire and then suddenly my phone bleeps because we have the Nest smoke detectors and says the smoke detector has gone off. And I'm like, oh, is Melanie cooking? Because every time we cook anything in the oven, the smoke detectors go off. It's a thing. And so I texted
We actually had a really light dinner. I just had some leftovers and Lucy had a couple of tostadas. She'd never had a tostada before, but she ate two of them. She really liked them. And Anthony had some quesadillas. I made him two quesadillas. And then I went to use the bathroom. And while I was in the bathroom,
Anthony made himself a third quesadilla.
I didn't know he was making another quesadilla. I'm in the bathroom and the smoke alarms go off. Like, not like all of the smoke alarms in the entire house go off. And I'm in the bathroom saying, "What's going on, guys?" And then I like rush out of the bathroom and Anthony has already turned off the stove and moved the pot off the burner and put the quesadilla on a plate and put it in the freezer to cool down. So he was fine.
He took care of it.
But he had accidentally turned this. He didn't know what temperature to cook it at and he didn't ask. And so he cooked it on high and that thing was like black. But to give him credit, he ate the blackened quesadilla.
It's a new thing. The Cajun blackened quesadilla.
He was not thrilled, but he ate the whole thing. And then he went and made himself a fourth quesadilla.
Wow.
And that one he didn't burn. So it was a learning experience.
Look at him making himself quesadillas.
I was impressed. He did a great job.
I would prefer he wait till you were out.
Yeah. Kind of said, you know, maybe like next time, just wait until I'm out of the bathroom, like, get everything ready, but just like wait to turn on the stove until I'm here.
Don't give your mother a heart attack while she's in the bathroom.
I mean, poor kid.
I can imagine it freaked him out a bit.
but he did. He was fine. It was fine.
And then bedtime?
Bedtime was really funny because Lucy has never not slept with other people. So like when
she's never slept in a room alone,
right? She, you know, when she was a baby, she slept in the room with us and then she moved into a room with her two big sisters. And so she's always had two big sisters to share her room with her. And she's not really happy when they're not there. She does not like sleeping alone. So I offered to let her sleep with me, but the thing is, I don't go to bed at the same time she does, like nowhere near the same time she does.
Hours later. Yeah.
And so she would be still sleeping alone in my room, which is not really any better than sleeping alone in her room. So I offered to let her camp out on the floor in Anthony's room. And she and Anthony decided to do that, but with a twist, because the floor in the room was covered with Legos. And they decided that since Ben wasn't there, they were going to camp out in his top bunk, both of them together.
So you texted me this. I made the mistake of telling Bella and Sophie without realizing Ben was behind me. Oh, they're sleeping in Ben's bed. They're what?
He was not thrilled.
He was not thrilled. I'm like, dude, don't worry about it.
So
they fell asleep.
I was amazed. I put them to bed wicked early. And they were both, they were in bed by like 8. And I just like, you know, I watched a video on my laptop and I think they're being real quiet. I better check on them and see how they're doing. And it was like barely 9 o'clock and they're usually up way later than that. And I walked in and Lucy was like sound asleep. I couldn't tell for sure with Anthony because he sleeps very frequently with the blanket over his head.
He's always
like,
done that.
Like a mummy.
A little kid.
Which is funny. My brother does the same thing. But the blanket was over his head and he did not like move at all when I said, "Hey guys, how's it going?" So I just turned off the light and tiptoed away and they were fine. Lucy, in the morning, this morning when I asked them, Anthony said he slept fine. Lucy said he kicked her all night.
Which is not surprising. The only thing surprising is she didn't kick him all night because...
Well, she probably did and he slept right through it.
Yeah, that's true. Because like when I go in there in the morning and it's like anytime I go in there, she is laying like half on the floor. Like her head's on her mattress and the rest is on the floor. She moves around all night. So,
but they were fine. I mean, they had a great time, I think. Like just the two of them. And then we went to Mass this morning, just the three of us.
Yeah.
Which was kind of unusual.
Yeah. Yeah. And we got back around 11:30 noon from the camping. So, yeah, even though we got up at 5, it took a while to get everybody up, get breakfast, get packed up, and then get out of there. Yeah. It was good. And then this afternoon was just
everybody crashed.
We're crashing like
you.
Crazy.
You crashed so hard that when the kids vacuumed the living room, like around you, you didn't even wake up when the vacuum cleaner was running like right next to your head.
I mean, there are times when they're moving around or doing stuff, and I keep my eyes closed because I just don't want to I don't want to be awake. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even wake up. Like I didn't even notice that they were vacuuming around me. I was that wiped out. So, yeah. So, so the other thing I was going to mention is, so Bella is in first communion. She's in confirmation preparation. She's fine. You know, at that stage, it's a 2-year program in her parish, and it's because of COVID, it's all remote and that sort of stuff right now. But I got an email from the parish, secretary or the coordinator saying they needed our records. They needed Bella's records. They need her baptism record. And they said they needed her first communion record. And I'm thinking, what's a first communion record? Like, you know, come to Mass on Sunday, I'll take a picture and hand it to you. She received communion. You know, it's like the reason we get a baptism record is because it's a permanent, indelible mark. It's a one-time thing. But you go to communion every Sunday, you know, usually, ideally. You go to communion every Sunday, like,
and nobody checks to make sure that you've like got an official first communion certificate before they give you communion.
And honestly, you technically do not have to be receiving communion in order to get confirmed. Technically, you would be bad if you never received communion when you presented.
They used to do confirmation before first communion, didn't they?
Like, well, right. That's the traditional or the ancient order of confirmation is it's baptism. In confirmation and then first communion and I mean confession and first communion we don't ask for first confession certificates. You know, it's just this weird bureaucracy paperwork thing that this kind of cropped up and this idea like because part of the problem is our kids don't usually go through the traditional parish religious ed programs. We do it ourselves. We're capable of, I have a theology degree, I'm capable and you're capable of forming our children in the faith, and we've always gone through our pastor and talked to him about, you know, when it's time. We don't do the parish first communion program. Bella, so Sophie, Ben.
Long and short, there may not actually be an official record. It depends on whether because she didn't go through the DRE. Did
Father
pastor Curry
bother to go to this to a some book in the parish office afterwards and write it in there?
Maybe
is he probably didn't. So. Yeah, and so if we don't cough it up, does she not get confirmed? I mean, it seems like a silly extra paperwork. I never understood this when I worked in a parish. I didn't understand it. It's just like I'd love to an explanation of why this is necessary. Like, why do we need this extra paperwork?
Right, like you can't confirm somebody who isn't baptized. That makes sense.
You have to be baptized in order to be confirmed. But there is no need. Like, do you need to prove that you've received your first communion to get married? No, I mean, it's just this. It's a, I don't know. It's just silly extra paperwork. So anyway, that's my little rant about this little bit of bureaucracy. I don't blame the parish secretary. It's just the rule that's out there, but it's kind of silly. Anyway, so let's talk about food.
All right. We've been eating.
So last week I made a dish that I've made before, but I haven't made in a long time. It's called, Spanish name is Lomo Saltado. It's also called Peruvian steak stir fry with tomatoes and onion. And this is another one of those Milk Street dishes, which I really enjoy. And what really makes it interesting, so it calls for flat steak. I use London broil. And the reason I made it was because London broil was on sale at the market. And so I'm like, let's make some of that. And so what makes it interesting is you thin slice the steak, you marinate it with cumin and salt, pepper, and soy sauce. So I like the idea of using the soy sauce to marinate it. And then you cook it in vinegar, red wine vinegar, which gives it a really interesting, like, savoriness. It's really, it gives, like, that bite of vinegar, that acidity. But it's also got tomatoes and onions. And I didn't have enough red onion, so I did, like, half red onion, half yellow onion, like a sweet onion.
It was fine.
Yeah. I also did like a quarter of the amount of jalapeno that it calls for because our kids do not want jalapenos. So I really liked it. I had the rest of it today for lunch. I mean, I made it last Thursday, I think it was. And it was still just as good. I mean, and the sauce is really good. Like I served it over rice. So lomo saltado, which is really good. It's really good. Highly recommend it. So it's got garlic as well. It's the only other ingredient I mentioned, the grape tomatoes. Really good. So, and then the other thing was I wanted to mention was the cooking over this weekend at the camping trip. One of the scoutmasters, or you know, the assistant scoutmaster Dan, is really Dan and Adam, the two of the assistant scoutmasters, are both really big into outdoor cooking, and they really go all out. They made a pork butt in a Dutch oven that was like simmered in first cider vinegar and then apple cider. It was so good. It was, you know, then you shred it, so good. But the star of the show were these two tomahawk steaks. Now, if a tomahawk steak is a new thing, I'm going to look it up, what exactly the right cut is. So it's basically, it's a prime rib steak.
Uh-huh.
So it's a beef rib. So it's really thick because it's the thickness of the rib. And so you have basically it's a bone on the bone rib steak. What they did was they wrapped the bone in foil so that it didn't burn. I'm not sure why that matters.
Because burned bone doesn't taste good?
I think it might have been part. Yeah, the burned bone would have been part of the taste too.
It would have given it a bad taste. Burning bone is not a good smell.
Then they hung it on hooks over, like they literally put it on a hook over the open campfire and just let it hang and cook there. And it was so good. It's not cheap. I think Dan said it was like $10 a pound that he paid.
That's expensive.
Yeah. So not cheap, but to divide it up between all of the adults and kids, yeah, everybody got a little bit. It wasn't that bad. It was really good. It's kind of amazing, all these new cuts of beef that are out there, you know, to really highlight different parts of the cow that you get these days. It's really interesting. So that was good. And then tonight we were looking for something a little different. And one of the things that was left over from the camping trip was a big bag of shredded cheddar cheese. And so you had a fun idea for how to use that up.
Well, I've been craving this soup for a few days now. I'm not even sure why. But one of my favorite soups is a mashup between broccoli cheddar soup and potato and cheddar soup. So basically, it's broccoli potato cheddar soup. And I usually serve it with bacon and scallions. It's like thick and creamy and potato, with like that thickness of a potato soup.
It's basically a loaded baked potato soup.
Right. I mean, because that's my favorite baked potato. It has like broccoli and bacon and scallions and sour cream. And this is basically that in a soup, which Lucy said, that makes it sound really disgusting. I don't want baked potato soup. I'm like, I don't understand why this is a problem, but okay, we'll call it something else. It's one of my favorites. It was not a huge hit. Anthony wouldn't even try it. Bella took a few bites and said, I'd rather have something else.
She had her leftovers.
Lucy ate an entire bowl and Sophie ate a bowl. Ben didn't even try it. But I was happy. It was good. I made some garlic bread croutons. We had some leftover French bread. And I tossed it with butter and olive oil and
garlic.
Garlic and Parmesan cheese and some oregano.
And then bake it in the oven for a bit.
Yeah.
Those are really good. And yeah, and then a pound and a quarter of bacon.
and there was like a whole, there was an entire bag of cheese in that soup too.
Yeah, that whole bag of cheese that Dan gave me, because Dan does not like cheese at all. So he said, take this or I'm throwing it away. So I took it and we used it, which is great. There's a lot of leftover soup. We're going to be eating that for a few days.
I was thinking maybe we might even put some in the freezer for like, save it for another day.
You mean that new freezer that we can store all kinds of stuff in?
Mm-hmm.
Like even like Sophie's birthday cake and...
Right. When you have a birthday during Lent, there's this problem. Like I am willing to sort of say we're not going to fast from birthday cake for your actual birthday, but eating the leftovers like the day after seems, especially when the day after is a Friday, just seems to kind of be pushing it a little bit.
Mm. I forgot to mention, like, what it was Sophie's birthday this past week.
It was.
I knew I was forgetting something we did. This camping trip took over my mind. So, yeah, Sophie's birthday. She's a teenager now.
She turned 13.
And you made her a cake, which came out looking awesome. Your cake-making skills are really hitting the stride.
Yeah, I made her a double-layer chocolate cake with a sort of a cream cheese frosting mashed with a buttercream frosting. It was like half cream cheese, half butter.
I think the ratio was with the buttercream. It was really good. I'm okay with cream cheese frosting, but I like a buttercream. This was a nice balance. Right.
I mean, my personal favorite frosting is just cream cheese, like with no butter in it, because I really like that zingy, tangy cream cheese. But
regular frosting is way too sweet.
Right.
Yeah, it's over the top.
Like a regular buttercream frosting is too sweet for me.
Yeah, it is. I agree. But
so this was like
a little balance is really good.
Right. I also, with the frosting and the cake both, I put some coffee in it.
Mm-hmm.
I put some espresso powder and some liquid coffee into the cake. And then with the frosting, when I was making it, I had an iced coffee sitting there and the frosting was way too thick. And I really didn't want to drink all of this iced coffee. So I just sacrificed some of the iced coffee to the frosting. And it wasn't, I mean, it was coffee that had a lot of milk in it and a lot of ice. And so what ended up in the frosting was not super strong. It didn't have a super coffee flavor, but it was just enough, I think, of the bitter coffee to kind of also help to cut
the sweet
of the powdered sugar.
I agree. And then
I was happy with the way it came out.
We got her some presents, of course. Mostly Star Wars stuff, of course.
It was all Star Wars.
Well, except for you got her a Saint book.
I did. I got her a book about Margaret Burgoy, who is a pioneering nun in the U.S., who I haven't actually read the book, so I don't know anything more about it than that.
I'll have to ask the Crows from American Catholic History.
Yes.
If they have any more information on her.
Anyway, Sophie loves to read Saint books, and so we haven't got her a new one in a while. It's kind of hard to find, actually, new books written at that age level. And she's almost ready to graduate to adult books, but I think she still kind of likes the kid books about saints.
She's at that really difficult transitional age of finding the right thing, the right presents.
Yeah, so she got
shirts.
A couple of Star Wars t-shirts, a Sabine Wren and a Mandalorian t-shirt. And she got a Lego Star Wars Kylo Ren's Knights of Ren shuttle, transport shuttle. Something.
That was mine. Choice.
And
very popular.
And I also an Ezra from
Ezra Bridger from
Ezra
Rebels.
Bridger from Rebels.
Yeah.
Figurine.
Also popular.
Yes.
And then your parents got her a Kanan figurine. And
so now she's almost got the whole Rebels crew.
Yes. And then she also got a mask, a Sabine, like a Mandalorian Sabine Wren.
That
mask.
Was from my sister.
Yes. Our kids are very Star Wars. So for dinner, Melanie is trying to plug in her phone because it's going to die. There's a gray cord over there hanging off the edge of the great podcasting. Just interrupt me so you can plug in your phone. Anyway.
I was trying not to interrupt.
Well, there's no way for me to tell you where it is without saying it aloud. So for dinner, the tradition is the child gets to choose where to go for dinner. We're not going anywhere these days, so we order in. And she chose Bertucci's, which is the Italian brick oven pizzeria place. It's, you know, sort of the mid-scale, not higher end than a pizza place, red sauce Italian sort of place. Anyway, we go there all the time. And so she wanted Bertucci's, so we ordered Bertucci's. She ordered pizza, which I know it's different from the pizza we usually get from the corner place, literally corner pizza. And it is a superior pizza, although not as great once it's traveled in the Postmates car for half an hour. But it was okay. I got like a shrimp dish, shrimp rossini. You got...
I got a veggie pizza, which would have been really good, except for some reason they decided to omit the red sauce. I was looking at the menu, and it didn't... like, all of the other pizzas tended to specify what kind of sauce, and this one didn't. But I was like, surely they're not going to actually give me just like a piece of dough with some veggies on it and some cheese and no sauce. But yeah, that's what indeed that's what they did. Yeah. And there was no way to specify, like, please add sauce to this.
Not unless you actually call. And
yeah.
Which is a pain. Who wants to do that?
Right.
Yeah.
It was okay, but it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't really what I was longing for.
Bella got her new favorite, which is chicken Alfredo, fettuccine Alfredo.
Fettuccine Alfredo.
Again, I'm tired. So that was, that was also what we ate this week. All right, let's move on. Moving on. Talking about what we're reading and watching. I watched two new Netflix series, still in the middle of them. One is more documentary style. One is an anime, actually, an American anime. So the documentary style one, it's a sort of like a dramatic documentary called Age of Samurai, The Battle for Japan. And it covered, I love the samurai stuff of Japan. I watched Shogun when I was too young to probably watching it when it was on, you know, the miniseries on TV starring Richard Chamberlain, Anjin-san. And then read the book by James Clavell, which was this giant, it was this giant book. It was at least 3 or 4 inches thick, the paperback. It was huge. And from that point on, I was fascinated by Japan and everything having to do with the samurai. But I didn't really know the history very well. And so this covers this particular century, not even really a whole century, at least not so far, where it was a time of intense warfare where this one daimyo, which is essentially a baron, the Japanese equivalent of a baron, of a minor province, kind of rose up and united all of Japan militarily. And it kind of goes through the machinations and some of these battles are some of the greatest battles in world history of their type. And it's kind of fascinating. And a lot of this history that I never knew before. And so it's a dramatic reconstruction. But they don't have lines, so you're seeing it as it's being described, what's going on, along with lots of historians, both Japanese and American and Canadian, I think, and a few European, talking about it in dramatic black and white. So the historians are being interviewed in dramatic black and white, and then the reconstructions are in color. It's really been pretty good so far. I've only watched a couple episodes of it, but it's fascinating and about a part of history and in a culture I don't know as much about as I would like to. So it's pretty good. I like it. Kind of gory, like unnecessarily, like showing, you know, seppuku. You know, they have a guy commit seppuku and you see the thing and they fall over and then the blood spreading all over the floor and it's like, or they behead somebody and you see the splash of blood like from off screen. Like you don't see the head roll, but you do see the splash of blood. I'm like, it's a little more than we need. I don't really need that. So there is that. So if the sight of blood it makes you squeamish, it won't be for you.
Okay.
And then the other thing I watched is an anime called Pacific Rim: The Black. Now, you may be familiar with the two Pacific Rim movies that came out, which feature giant robots piloted by people fighting kaiju, which is the Japanese term for big monsters like Godzilla. And so the first one was pretty good. It was not high art, but it was a good romp of monsters fighting monsters, monsters fighting robots. Okay. Second one was not nearly as good. This one is an anime which follows a brother and sister in the same universe. They're Australian and Australia has been evacuated because of the kaiju roaming around the continent. But they get left behind and how they get there. Apparently it's about how they get their way out. So it's very anime, very much in the style of not just the artwork, but of the style of storytelling. So if you like anime, you'll probably like that. So that was pretty good. How about you?
Haven't been doing a whole lot. After I finished Death Comes with the Archbishop, I decided to...
For the Archbishop, not with the Archbishop.
Death
Comes with the Archbishop is a horror movie that they're making.
I hope not. I decided to keep on with Willa Cather for a while. I intended to read something else and I couldn't find the book. And I had more Willa Cather on the Kindle and I just popped it open because I was looking for something to read at bedtime. And so I started reading O Pioneers, which is very different in terms of tone and even kind of in terms of style. It takes place in Nebraska, and it involves a group of immigrants, primarily Norwegian or Swedish?
Swedish.
Primarily Swedish, although there are some French immigrants in the community too, and some Bohemians and Germans, I think. And the protagonist is a young Swedish girl who is sort of, her father has come from Sweden, and he wasn't a farmer in Sweden, but he's decided to farm, you know, take some land in Nebraska to try to farm his hand at farming. And he is not a great farmer, but she actually is. So she takes the family farm. She makes some wise investments with the help of her brother after her dad dies. And she grows into this like huge profitable farm, but she never marries. And her brothers do not really give her the credit and respect. They're like, Yeah. You helped to like make some investments, but we're the ones who did all the work, so we should get the property, which doesn't seem fair at all.
Right.
So where I am now, her childhood, I wouldn't say childhood sweetheart, but they were best friends as children, who he went off to seek his fortune elsewhere, has come back, but she's 40, and everybody in the community thinks it's ridiculous that she would ever think about getting married. And this would-be love interest hasn't really done anything significant of himself. So she's this woman of property and he has nothing, and he doesn't feel like he can marry her when he doesn't bring anything to the table. And she's like, what does that matter?
Right.
But, and yeah, her brothers do not want her to get married because they think it will make them look ridiculous. They're very full of themselves. And also they don't think that she should get married and have kids, because then the property might go to her kids instead of to their kids. And they don't think that she should have a right to it because the men should rule.
Of course.
So I like it though. I really like Willa Cather's storytelling, and I really like again, there's not a whole lot of the interior. Although it's clear that people have these rich interior lives, the storytelling doesn't dip deeply into that. It sort of hints at it, which I kind of like. And then I haven't done a lot of watching. I did watch last night while you were gone. I watched an episode of Endeavor, which is fun.
A British series.
Have I talked about that before? I don't remember.
Yeah.
So there was a British detective series called Inspector Morse that ran for years on the BBC. I've never seen it. And Endeavor is a prequel that takes place in the 60s when Morse is a young up-and-coming police detective, or he hasn't made detective yet. He's
just a regular constable.
I can't
PC. The current term is.
And so yeah, it's kind of dark. It's kind of gritty. It sort of like deals with a lot of social issues. Like the episode I watched last night has to do with a lot of what they call Kenyan Asians, which are Indians who settled in Kenya and have been kicked out of Kenya and so have migrated to Britain, and there's a lot of prejudice against them. So, and then there was also this whole plot line about Egyptian mummies and an Egyptian mummy, like a mummy movie. there's an Egyptian, the guy who accompanies the mummies from Egypt, and so he's like an archaeologist and a scholar. It takes great offense at the horror movie featuring a mummy. This is disrespectful to our culture, and everyone kind of shouts him down because like, he's just a crazy Arab. So, I mean, it deals with a lot of the prejudices and stereotypes and the conflicts that are going on. And I really like the show. The guy who plays Morse is really engaging and interesting. And the episodes are really long, though. They're like an hour and a half each. Like each one is almost a movie.
Huh. Weird.
Yeah. The pacing is very different from like American
British
cop shows.
Yeah, British shows, they have these weird, like they're weird lengths. Like they'll be like an hour and 40 minutes or, you know, 52 minutes or something like that. But they also have weird season lengths, you know, or series, they call them. You know, there'll be 4 episodes or 8 episodes or, it's hard to predict.
Right. But it's good. It's a nice, there are other things I could have watched. I had thought about watching a movie and then it was getting late and I didn't want to stay up too late.
So I usually like police procedurals. The problem is a lot of the contemporary police procedurals on American TV have gotten so politically correct that they're really annoying. And so I started watching the British ones on BritBox, and there's just something different about them, and they're enjoyable, partly because they're fresh. They're not
right
the tried and true, same old, rehashed storylines. And I've been getting into them. They're kind of interesting.
I think you'd like Endeavor.
Probably.
So he's paired up with this older, experienced detective, Thursday, who's kind of old school, not afraid to get his hands dirty a little bit.
Right.
Not corrupt exactly, but he doesn't hold back in, you know, being a little bit rough with some of the criminals at times.
Oh, like Sean Connery in that version of
The Untouchables?
The Untouchables.
Yeah, it's kind of along those lines.
I was going to say The Incredibles, but I like Sean Connery.
Definitely not in the Incredibles.
Although he would have been awesome. Let's just say that.
Oh, by the way, I just remembered something that I wanted to say earlier when we were talking about camping.
Okay.
Because it reminded me when we were doing the intro to the show, this is a story, a podcast about pirates and penguins. One of the things that when I was doing the last minute checklists for your camping trip.
Oh yes, for the gear, making sure they have all their things.
Right, like the things that like we'd already packed the bags the night before, but like the things you want to not forget to grab on your way out the door.
That's true.
Included, you know, blankets and pillows and toothbrushes and that sort of thing. And Sophie's included penguins.
Penguins. She took her 2 penguins.
Because we could not leave.
Waddle and Slidey must go on the adventure.
Yeah. I just thought that was really funny.
Like, yes.
Even at 13, she's still very attached to her penguins.
Yes. Yes. A girl can get away with that. A 13-year-old boy would not get away with bringing a stuffed animal.
You know, it's kind of funny, though. I think that, like, by the time they hit, like, college age, then that becomes sort of more of an eccentricity.
For girls?
No, even
for boys. Maybe. You start to come up with, there's ways in which such things become possible, depending on your personality that you portray.
Right. Yeah. I remember that our friend Brendan Hodge talks about how he carried a stuffed ferret around his freshman year in college.
Well, there's always that guy.
Right.
You know, the guy who's got a thing, you know, you got to have a thing to stand out.
Right. And I think college is the time when people like try out these different personas, things.
Like, there's always the guy who wears a suit and carries a briefcase to class.
That was totally my friend Matt Crouch, which you would not believe.
When I met Matt Crouch, that was totally not Matt.
I mean, by the time like we got to like sophomore or junior year, he was the long haired guy with the goatee who was like chain smoking and wearing a trench coat. But our freshman year, he was clean cut, wore a suit and tie, and carried a briefcase. Would you believe it?
I would not believe it, having met Matt. That is far from, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So you gotta have a thing, stand out. A lot of people have a thing. So I can imagine a stuffed animal being a thing.
Right.
I don't picture Brendan with the thing.
It helps maybe if you think that like he was a big fan of Brideshead Revisited and Sebastian and Brideshead Revisited carries a teddy bear around Oxford.
Okay.
So it sort of becomes a like cool Oxford literary thing.
Oh, okay. I get that. And he was a classics major, wasn't he?
He was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, classics majors. Anyway. Moving on.
So stuffed animals, guys.
Yep.
When I was in grad school, I actually bought myself a stuffed hippo.
Well, I had stuffed animals from when I was a kid.
I mean, I had a
stuffed seal.
But I didn't bring any of my stuffed animals from home. I mean, by the time I was going to grad school, I was thinking of myself as too old for that. But I don't know. I got like partway through and I just sort of just was in a toy store one day with some friends killing time and this really cute hippo just grabbed my attention, and I thought, you know, I could use a stuffed hippo on my bed.
And the parallels how we met. This really cute thing caught my eye. I should Keep them around.
Yeah.
A little stuffed hippo. I'm just your little stuffed hippo. So moving
on. Kid on the bed.
Self-deprecating humor. So let's talk about the readings for Mass this week, because we had a really interesting conversation about the readings for the third Sunday of Lent that came up, and Father Mike's homily that you were telling me about, and some of the things that I was thinking about in relation to it. So just as a refresher, the first reading is the Ten Commandments. It's basically just the Ten Commandments. There's a long version and a short version.
We got the short version at Mass, which confused me when I was trying to follow along and had me flipping.
Yes, because it skipped a whole bunch of stuff.
And I was kind of sad, too, because I think that the longer version is more interesting.
Well, yeah. And then the second reading is Paul's letter to the Corinthians, where we have the famous lines, for the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength.
I love that one.
Yeah. And then the gospel is the money changers in the temple.
Right.
Jesus flipping tables. You know, everybody loves to quote the Jesus flipping tables. So let's talk about this. You said that you mentioned that someone's online who was questioning in the first reading the commandment. So we all memorize it as thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, but it's really thou shalt not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male or female slave, nor his ox or an ass, or anything else that belongs to him.
Right. I mean, we kind of separate that out into don't covet your neighbor's wife and don't covet your neighbor's goods, but it's kind of...
It's a sentence.
Right. It's one thought.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I somebody shared sort of in a private group I'm in this kind of wry commentary on they had seen somebody who was complaining about that verse. And couldn't we like just change the translation, because the whole idea of like not coveting slaves was really bothersome to this person. And I guess the idea that like my neighbor doesn't have a slave, and if they did, I wouldn't covet it. So we shouldn't have that commandment in the Bible.
Yeah. Well,
or at least not read it at Mass, or just redact it out.
I'm not sure. Like, maybe you should check with God before you start deciding that bits of his inspired word need to be redacted out. You know what I mean?
Which is kind of funny, because one of the things that Father Michael talked about in his homily was about the perfection of the Decalogue.
Right.
He, in fact...
Well, the responsorial psalm, which I didn't mention, Psalm 19, says the law of the Lord is perfect.
Right. And Father Mike quoted that. And then he went on to talk about how, like... So with COVID, he used the example of COVID regulations and rules. Like in Massachusetts, we have a, you know, you must wear a mask rule, and we have, you know, social distancing and standing 6 feet away. And Father Mike said, you know, these rules are not perfect and they will go away. Like, things are getting better. And as things get better, these rules are going to be rolled back and they will eventually go away. It is not good for us to stand 6 feet apart from our loved ones
forever.
It's not good to wear masks forever. They are necessary evils, but the law of the Lord,
or even necessary temporary goods,
right? But there's not really good to be apart.
Sure.
Right. But the law of the Lord, the Ten Commandments, these do not pass away. They do not change. We are not going to get to the point where we don't need them anymore, because they are perfect.
Right. And so the question then becomes is, in this commandment, why does God just assume that someone would have a male or female slave? Like, why doesn't he just condemn slavery? Thou shalt not keep slaves.
Right. He could have. I mean, he said, don't murder. And he said, don't commit adultery. And he said, don't bear false witness. Why didn't he say, don't keep slaves?
It's an interesting question. And I think part of it has to do with the accommodation. No, I don't think it's about accommodation. I think one of the things that God is saying here is, slavery was different back then, for one thing. It was more like in most cases, or in many cases in this context, in this culture, it was like indentured servitude.
Well, one of the things that God does do in the Law of Moses is he proclaims that every 7 years you'll have a jubilee year, and right. in the jubilee year you will free all of your slaves.
Right.
So slavery was at most a 7-year indentured servitude with a definite end date.
Right.
When the jubilee year comes around, you will free your slaves. So it's not lifelong slavery, and it's certainly not like lifelong slavery for you and your children and all of your descendants.
And even chattel slavery, like you weren't property. You'd be even like slaves had rights. They weren't just simply dehumanized property. So one of the things is to understand the context. We use the word slavery to mean a lot of different things.
Right. What the Bible is talking about is not at all the same as the American institution of racial chattel slavery.
Right. Now,
it's closer to the kind of indentured servitude that a lot of people experienced when they couldn't afford the boat fare across from Europe.
Right.
And so they would indenture themselves and they would work off the boat fare when they got here.
Right.
It's closer to that. Like, a lot of it had to do with debt. Either you were a slave because you owed money, or you were a slave because you lost a war and you were taken as captive,
right,
like a prisoner of war.
Now, the question then becomes is why does God say, do not covet your neighbor's male or female slave? And there's an interesting spiritual potential there, which is maybe what God is saying here is don't covet your neighbor's thing that is not good for your neighbor to own, to have. You know, it's not, slavery is not good. If it were good, then there wouldn't be a need to declare a jubilee and free the slaves. You know what I mean? So it is a accommodated bad thing. I mean, a necessary evil, or maybe some, you could say it in different ways, but it's not a good thing. And God's saying, don't covet the thing your neighbor is doing that's not good. And I think there's a truth in that. How often, from our perspective now, we can make this contemporary for us. How often do we covet the things our neighbor has or does that is not good for our neighbor, that is perhaps sinful? How often do we covet our neighbor's sinfulness? Oh my, my neighbor, he doesn't go to mass. He doesn't go to church. He just sleeps in all Sunday. Man, I wish I could sleep in on Sunday. I get to get up and go to mass. You're coveting something that you shouldn't covet. Like, you shouldn't want that. And, or, you know, oh, my neighbor, that guy, he's always dating those, you know, those young things, or he's always stepping out on his wife with those good. I mean, it's bad to cheat on your wife. Oh, it's terrible. But man, he's with those beautiful young things all the time. You maybe shouldn't be coveting that, maybe.
Right.
You know, or, and I'm doing it from a guy perspective, but there's probably a feminine perspective for that as well.
Right. When you see somebody doing something that they shouldn't be doing, that's not good for them. And you
think how cool, how much fun that
it
would be.
It would be nice if I didn't have to follow this rule that says I shouldn't do that.
Yes.
I think that's an interesting way to sort of ponder it and make it more relevant, because obviously we look around and we say, my neighbor doesn't have slaves, so how could I possibly covet it?
Right.
The other direction I was taking it in a discussion with some of my friends was, we were talking about the ways in which, no, we don't have slavery by that name, but there certainly are in our world a lot of people who...
There are still slaves in the world.
There are slaves in the
world.
Well,
there's still slaves in the United States.
Right. There are slaves. We like to pretend that we have abolished the institution of slavery, and we have as an institution, but we haven't really as a practice. And
there are people who are being taken advantage of and exploited by criminals, for instance, in various enterprises. I do not have to go into detail with that. There are people who come into this country without the benefit of the law. They're outside the law and therefore easily exploitable by unscrupulous people who put them to work in such ways as they can never pay off their debt. And they are essentially slaves.
Right.
Right here in this country. And how often do we benefit from that?
Right. In ways that maybe aren't necessarily directly, but
if you wear inexpensive clothing, if you every time you buy food that isn't, you know, that's inexpensive. I mean, not that it's necessarily produced by slaves, but some of it is.
The chances that you have nothing in your house that was produced with some slave labor in some of the component is practically nil.
Right.
I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably listening on a device that has some component that was made in some other country that was made with labor that was not justly compensated.
At some point in the supply chain. Point.
Right.
Right.
So we are all, in some degree or other, complicit with the exploitation of other human beings, which is really the this.
And the cooperation with evil might be extremely remote, but it's still a cooperation of some sort.
Right. And so that wrestling with that is something that we should do. We should wrestle with and try to reduce the injustice in the world of exploited persons, people whose labor is not justly compensated, who are slaves. And so that coveting one's neighbor's goods still applies in our world in many different ways.
Yeah. One thing I would want to mention about the gospel is, you know, when Jesus drives the money changers out of the temple. Sorry, I'm still I'm on the verge of going to bed. So because I'm still so tired still. So Jesus drives the money changers out of the temple because they have taken a sacred place for worship of God and turned it to a profane use, a use that is not sacred.
Right. It is set aside for worship.
And you said that Father Mike had an interesting insight on that one.
One of the things that Father Mike talked about was what Jesus says about tearing down the temple and rebuilding it in 3 days. And Father Mike points out that, of course, Jesus is talking about the temple of his body and that we now worship. He says in the alternate gospel reading for today, we would have heard about him talking to the Samaritan woman about worshiping in spirit and in truth. And Father Mike made a really interesting point, which is that all of us, when we leave Mass, having received the Eucharist, are walking tabernacles. We are the temple. We are the sacred space. We are the holy place. And it's kind of interesting to think about what things would Jesus want to drive out of the sacred space that is me.
Our hearts. Yeah.
My heart. I can think of quite a few things. Oh, it's a good thing we're having confession on Friday. And then I thought that connected really nicely with what Mother Sophia was saying, which she was saying that in the last three Gospels of Lent, Jesus takes us to these places that are set apart. He takes us to the desert. It takes us to the top of the mountain. Those are both outside of the city and places where we encounter God. We encounter God in the desert. We encounter God up on the mountain. She says, today we go to the temple, which is in the city. And yet it's this place inside the city that's set apart, that's Jesus makes very explicit. It's set apart from the marketplace. It should not be the marketplace.
Right.
A quiet place in the middle of the city, surrounded by the marketplace that's not the marketplace, that makes room for an encounter for God. Now, Mother Sophia, being a Benedictine, talks about how the monastery is that place, but I think that her words apply to all of us. The need for finding quiet in our lives to set aside our hearts, to set aside some of our time for God in prayer. And in work.
It doesn't have to be a place specific, although if that's what you need to do this, it would be great. But you have to set aside time and a space in your heart.
And let's face it, and Lent is partly that. It's about setting aside time. I got to say, my Lent is not going really great in terms of setting aside time for prayer and scripture reading. It's just not been happening. Like I try to, I make plans to, and then I keep not doing it. So this is sort of aspirational. Like,
yeah,
it's we're 3 weeks into Lent. How's your Lent going? Mine's not going great, but it's not too late.
Right. It's never too late.
It's never too late. And
until it is.
So thinking about that, like setting aside time, making Lent a space of encounter with God in the middle of the hustle and bustle.
Yeah. God, in the gospel, it says that the disciples recall the words of scripture, zeal for your house will consume me. You are the house of God. The zeal for the house of God should consume you. Be consumed with the need to cleanse your temple, to cleanse yourself, and make yourself a sacred space for God. I think that's the lesson this week. I think that's a good time to wrap things up. So let's take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Les H., Andrew G., John S., Steve N., and Miguel G. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets on all the shows at StarQuest. Now's a great time to become a StarQuest patron, thanks to a generous gift from a StarQuest supporter. When you start a new Patreon monthly pledge at sqpn.com/give, the first 3 months will be matched by an equal amount from our donor to support all our shows, including this one, which makes your gift go even further. And don't forget, StarQuest is a 501c3 Catholic apostolate nonprofit. Your donations are tax deductible as far as they go according to the law, etc. Contact your tax professional. But we are more than halfway to our goal of $2,000 in new monthly pledges, which is a huge thing that will help us for some future projects we need to take care of. So won't you help us close the gap? If you've been thinking of becoming a StarQuest patron, now's the time. Visit sqpn.com/give today. So that's it from us. We'd love to hear from you. You can contact us at sqpn.com/bets, B-E-T-T-S, or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. You can find our show notes at sqpn.com. If you can get a chance, please, it helps us a lot if you can write a review at Apple Podcasts. It's been a while since we got a review in the Apple Podcasts or any other directories, so we'd really appreciate that. That helps get the show out to new people, as does sharing the podcast with your friends. We really appreciate it. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.